My name is Emma Bryan. I am here with Bob Thurmond. We are in the living room of his home, and we are going to be talking about his life growing up in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and we are also going to be speaking about his parents' civic and social activism. The date is May 23rd, 2018. So for the record, could we just go ahead and go through your siblings, like their birth order, like who was the oldest and who was the youngest, and their names? All eight of them?
Hal Jr. was the eldest. He passed away some years ago, early 2000s. I don't remember exactly when that is.
Okay.
Elizabeth is the eldest of us now, and because all the grandmas, all the aunts, all the uncles, everybody is dead, she is the oldest generation. Oldest of our generation and the oldest person in the family. It's a really awful burden to carry with a family like ours. And then there was Bill, or William, who passed away in 1994, I think. Tragic house fire in Hopkinsville. He was the last of us to live in Hopkinsville. So there's no more of us in Hoptown. David, who is a little more than a year older than I am, than me, than Mark, who, this is going to sound like a tragic family, passed away 3 years ago in Lexington. Mary Lou is the youngest daughter, and she lives in Henry County. I think David has given you her contact information, or
yes,
maybe
we
not.
Do have it.
Okay. And you know how to get in touch with her.
Yes.
Yeah. And then baby Patrick lives in Florida.
Okay.
And the baby, I think, is old, I think. How old is Patrick? He'll be 63 this year.
Sure. Okay.
Pretty frightening, isn't it?
When did you graduate from Bellarmine?
100 years ago.
I went to Bellarmine for my
72.
Gotcha. Okay.
68 was the first year of co-ed education at Bellarmine.
Yeah. So that was your first year then?
That was my freshman year.
Gotcha.
And it's been downhill for Bellarmine. No.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved Bellarmine.
Bellarmine's
a
good school.
It was a great school. Yeah. Okay, so moving right along into our second question. When and where were you born? And could you discuss what your childhood was like?
To the extent that I remember anything.
Of course.
I was born in Russellville, Kentucky on November 30th, 1950. Is that right? Yeah. And I've been told that we moved almost exactly a month later, right after the first of the year. In 1951, from Russellville to Hopkinsville. That was my entire... We never lived anywhere else other than Hopkinsville the whole time. Childhood, all I remember about my early childhood is everything was just very white bread. You know, school was at the end of the block. Grocery store was over there. We walked down there to go to a convenience store. My first recollection that there was anything different about our neighborhood, Hopkinsville didn't really have any really integrated neighborhoods, not really. But there was a predominantly African-American neighborhood about a block away from us. And those kids were... You know, we just played in the backyard and it wasn't anything unusual. Even when I went to grade school at the one and only Catholic grade school there, having black neighbors and black friends wasn't anything that was remarkable. There wasn't a reason to think it was different until we got to high school. Or, in my case, to junior high school. And even though the schools were integrated at the time, they were very, very socially segregated, very much so. So I really wasn't aware that there was any white black stuff until I got out of grade school. I don't recall. There were some things that you've probably read about or Elizabeth told you that would have happened at our home when I was a kid. When we had a firebomb thrown on our front porch. We had a couple of crosses burned in the front yard. And my memory of those things, the contemporaneous memory of it, I don't remember being frightened. I don't remember anybody making a big deal out of it. I do remember my dad telling us that the people that did that were cowards and that they would are probably more afraid than we would ever be and just don't pay any attention to it. And we didn't.
So you said that your high school and your junior high school was socially segregated.
Segregated.
Can you talk a bit about what that means?
Not very many black kids showed up at official social functions, whether they were school sponsored or otherwise. There were social clubs, mostly girls' social clubs, called, get ready for this, Sub Deb 1 and Sub Deb 2. Don't know why there were two of them. They were all white.
And Sub Deb was debutante,
I
or
suppose so.
okay.
Yeah. To my knowledge, they didn't have anything like a cotillion or any,
Okay.
but they may have.
Okay.
I didn't pay attention to a lot of stuff.
Gotcha.
And a lot of stuff that I may have paid attention to, I just don't remember. So, and I until I developed friendship with a handful of African American people my age, I didn't really know what the black social scene was. And I learned pretty quickly that, of course, there's social clubs that black kids belong to, weekend activities that they went to that were not like where white kids went to. There was a, this lasted maybe all the way through high school. There was a weekend teen activity center. I don't know who sponsored it. It might have been the Chamber of Commerce or the Rotary Club or maybe the city. I have no idea who sponsored it. It's called Teen Town. Yeah. And they had a wood floor and a jukebox, and it just was music. And so most teens gathered there, and did whatever else we did in our cars or whatever. Although it wasn't officially segregated, and there may have been one or two African American kids who would come to Teen Town. I don't know why, if you were a black kid in Hopkinsville, I don't know why you would. It was thoroughly boring. There were nearly never any black kids at at Teen Town.
Because they weren't welcome, or because they didn't want to be there? Both.
I never really asked anybody. I just
Okay.
assumed that that's what it
Yeah.
was. So when there were activities on the weekend where I wanted to be involved with African American kids, they were usually around school. Like, I was involved in the so-called drama club, kids who foolishly would appear on stage and take direction from an adult English teacher. So there were kids from, that was a pretty diverse group. Kids involved in the arts in general, music, theater, was pretty diverse. Interestingly enough, many, many, many African American kids, and I don't know how any of this worked, even though they lived within the city, they fell in the county school district. So it would be as if back in the ancient days when Louisville had a completely segregated county versus city, these black kids somehow, even though they lived in the city, they were in the county school district. So, and there were many more, total number, the county high school was bigger, but total number of black kids, there were many more African American kids, I believe, at the county high school than there were at Hopkinsville High. Yeah.
And you went to Hopkinsville.
And I went to Hopkins, the infamous Hopkinsville High School, right?
Why is it infamous?
Don't you know we had Fleming Thornton as a championship coach for football? You didn't know this? Oh my God. Hopkinsville High School was the state champion 2 years running and was like in that division, which. I don't think at the time they didn't have like 19 divisions. We were in the same division as most of the Louisville schools. And so we had a powerhouse.
Were you on the team?
No, my God, no. I was trying to play basketball, and in my senior year, the coach there, Jerry somebody, just, kind of casually at practice one day, he said, "You're going to college, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "You plan to play basketball?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, good." Tall and clumsy, couldn't jump, couldn't run,
Gotcha.
couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. David was a good basketball player, and I think he was All-State or something.
Okay.
I don't remember, but I think he
Gotcha.
was something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, and sports was another area. It's interesting. When it came to sports, there was not probably, there was certainly some racial animosity on a very low social level between black kids and white kids. But those sports teams were integrated way early. And the Hopkinsville and Christian County, which became a powerhouse in a lot of sports, they really depended on African American athletes to carry them. They really did.
Right.
Which, big surprise, huh? Yeah. And let's see what else. Like, growing up, what do I remember? Other than Bill accidentally hitting David in the face with a golf club.
You are welcome to tell that story if you remember.
I think it may have been sort of accidental frustration. David would know for sure.
Okay.
I don't think Bill went after him with a golf club, but he hit him somehow with a
Gotcha.
golf club in the
Okay.
face.
Now we have that on record
We've got it on
forever.
record. Hal, the oldest, and if you talk to Elizabeth about him, she may describe him as the meanest of all of our siblings. He did things like buy a BB gun and tell the younger of us, David and I think were victims of this at the same time. He would load his BB gun up, and we'd go in the backyard, and he'd say, "Okay, now run." And we would say, "What for?" And he says, "Because I'm going to see if I can shoot you with my BB gun." What? So we did. He would usually hit us in the ankle
Okay.
or the butt. Yeah, usually. No blood drawn.
Gotcha.
Let's see what else from early childhood. Catholic grade school, you know. I remember we had the first and second grade in the same room. Sister Rose something or other, Rose Nicholas. And I don't have very many recollections, except a couple of really distinct ones. There was a kid in our grade. This had to be first grade. David and I were in the same room, although he was second. The nuns had rigid order. We had a so-called art period. One of the things we had to do in that art period was take these little colored sticks, yellow, green, blue, whatever else, and make little things on our desks. And that was art. The kid's name was Tommy somebody. Sister, what's her name, came by his desk. He hadn't done anything. And she commanded him, you know, get busy. Something gruff. And he uttered an obscenity that nobody in the first grade had ever heard. That obscenity, you, sister. And she said, what? And he said it again. So she backhanded him, knocked him out of his chair, and that just opened this fountain of obscenity from this first grader. Like you have, I don't know, maybe you have heard it, but none of us had ever heard it. Which escalated the violence. He ended up getting whacked on the butt with a belt, as I recall, a couple of times. That it just, you know, he dug his heels in and was not going to retract. And just every lash he got was another spew of it. I don't recall, this nobody told us to turn our backs. Mm-hmm. This was going on in front of our classroom.
Wow.
Then eventually, when it was, the principal had come in, it became apparent that, you know, there was a real, like, nuclear standoff there. He had been moved to the back of the classroom in a separate desk. The principal came in. She was berating him just as the first grade teacher was, and he was being just as profane to her. So his mother shows up eventually, and she pleads with him. I don't know what she was trying to get him to do. I don't know, apologize or what, but the beatings continued, and finally there was a pause.
In front of the mother.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just don't. Anyway, there was a pause, and he bolted.
Wow.
Down the steps, there was a public park at the end of the block where that school was located, and he bolted and went down there. The principal enlisted the eighth grade boys to go round him up and drag him back to school. I don't think I've ever seen anything as brutal as that, ever.
Wow.
Ever. So that was an important childhood memory. The other ones have to do with, you know, lazy days at the swimming pool, chasing girls in the eighth grade, making fun of Mrs. Fox in the fourth grade because she had some speech impediment. Stuff that fourth graders do.
Yeah.
Somewhere in all of this, Dad was a very extreme is probably too strong, but very much a civic guy. Chamber of Commerce, Rotary Club, probably belonged to Kiwanis and all that stuff. And was a successful business person. He built a concrete block company from nothing with a little money from his father. And just, he became an extremely successful and influential business person, not just in Hopkinsville. He was influential in some of the early development, economic and political development in Western Kentucky. There is a road that's now, you know, like all roads, in disrepair, has been bypassed by other things, that connected Hopkinsville to the nearby military base called Fort Campbell Boulevard, and it was a big deal. Well, Dad was a big proponent of that and apparently had something to do with getting state money committed to the project so that it would happen. It was an extension of Highway 41. It's called 41A. I just remember that my brother Bill got to ride in a little go-kart after they cut the ribbon. He got to ride in a little go-kart with some cute girl next to him. I don't remember who that was. Somewhere in all of this, you know, this Catholic parish that we belong to was... Hopkinsville is very much in the middle of the Bible Belt. It's very much more southern than these environs are. In my youth, the largest building in the county second to the tobacco auction warehouse, was the Second Baptist Church. Our little Catholic church was this little, almost a mission, almost. 100 families, something like that. Wow. Dad had been raised as a Methodist, and somewhere in there he converted to Catholicism. The Catholic principles of the social gospel really appealed to him. So it was just, to him, natural that the civil rights movement was a social cause that required conscientious Catholics to be a part of. And he didn't back off. So this is a guy that was politically influential, an influential businessman, belonged to two all-white country clubs. There was a little bit of ostracization in terms of some of the people that they played bridge with and that kind of stuff when Dad became a real active civil rights person. Wouldn't have anything to do with him socially, but as far as we knew, it never affected his business, or if it did, he was very, very strategic about countering whatever that effect was. And he didn't soften his stance on civil rights because of it. From, you know, I think Rotary International had a no women allowed policy as late as the mid-80s.
Wow.
I think. But somehow in the late 60s, early 70s, nationally they desegregated, but he got the local Rotary Club desegregated when I was in high school, which was in the mid-60s. And I don't know how he did that. Just, you know, like everything Dad did, it was just sort of, you didn't really know what was going on. I don't know what the thinking was, but he had a very good friend, the only black attorney in Hopkinsville who was admitted to the local bar association and to the Kentucky Bar Association. Lewis McHenry Sr., Lewis P. McHenry Sr. And they were very good friends. Dad took him as his corporate counsel and his personal attorney. And they did two things early in their friendship. There was classic downtown, small town drugstore with a soda fountain kind of stuff. They went in there at lunchtime to have a hamburger or something, and they wouldn't serve Mr. McHenry. And so Dad said, well, you must. He's my friend. And they said, no, we're not going to serve him, and he has to leave. And Dad said, well, no, neither one of us are leaving. So they both got arrested that day.
Oh, wow.
And then another time, there's a bar in Hopkinsville. I'm sure it's still there. It's one of those, you know, kind of like Chex Cafe in Germantown in Louisville. Mm-hmm. It's never going to go away. It's like a cockroach. what was it called? The Manhattan Bar. And it's in this dark, this street where the buildings were like four stories tall on either side. Sun never shined on it. Just wow. Dark as it could be. I think it was a Friday night. He and Mr. McHenry went there. You know, they knew they wouldn't be served. They went there to be served. And staged a little sit-in and got kicked out and arrested. And it wasn't much later than that. The federal open accommodations legislation got passed. The Kentucky Fair Housing Act got passed. Dad was, and maybe subsequently mother too, Dad was a member of the Kentucky, what they call it, the Fair Housing or Open Housing Commission. A Frankfurt-based commission. Again, this was mid-60s, probably around the time Ned Breathitt was governor, probably. And I just remember those things as kind of achievements that we knew Dad was, we knew he was responsible for them. He didn't brag or anything like that. He just did them.
Yeah.
He also was very influential in his industry. Two different things. one of which now I think is an extremely white right-wing organization called the National Association of Manufacturers. They're even more conservative than the National Chamber of Commerce. Dad served as the president, the national president of the National Association of Manufacturers for 2 years. And then another time, maybe before that, he was president or chairman of the National Precast Concrete Association. It's a biggie. But, the lobbying organization for the concrete industry, basically. And he was president of that. Of course, he lobbied for the interest of his industry, but he also lobbied his industry for fair treatment, for benefits. Dad's a business. He had some truck drivers. They were a couple of times the Teamsters tried to organize them, and Dad didn't want that because he didn't want to lose the direct contact. So he told his workers, you go ahead and join the union, but whatever they offer you, I will offer you more. So get your offer from the union, you come back, and I'll beat it, whatever it is. Health insurance, sick pay, time off, all kinds of stuff that in a little lily white town in southwestern Kentucky in the 60s just didn't happen. It just didn't. So that connection to Washington, D.C. Led him to one or both of us, either me or David, usually both of us, would go to Washington with him whenever he lobbied. He was very proud to go visit the construction site of the National Cathedral there. I'm not sure quite how we have a National Cathedral. It just doesn't get it, but anyway, all concrete and stone. So he was really proud of that. And on one of those trips, he took David and I to, I think, a Senate NATO committee hearing. Wow. And Bobby Kennedy was chair of that committee. So, with absolutely no hesitation whatsoever, after the hearing was over, he just took us up to the front of the room, and like Bobby Kennedy had nothing better to do. I'm Hal Thurman from Hopkinsville, Kentucky. These are my boys, David and Bob, or he called me Bobby at the time. And Mr. Kennedy was quite gracious.
Wow.
He's a good man. Where do we start? Well, childhood.
Yeah, so you've talked about your father a little bit, and that kind of leads me to my next question, which was, what was the parenting style of your father and your mother? We've talked of you. He involved you, obviously, very much in his civic, duties and that sort of thing. So what did that look like for you?
There would be periods of time where Dad would just seem to be absent because he was gone on business, and so nearly all of the day-to-day parenting that I recall as a very young man was mother. And Dad's influence, his parental style, was very much guide you to somewhere and then let you do what you may. At least with me, and I don't think David, he never really gave either one of us any sort of, you'd probably be a good lawyer, or you'd probably be a good architect, or why don't you think about medical school? Never any of that. But the freedom, go to college, and at the time I majored in philosophy, and I'm sure I really don't know what he thought about, honestly. But his disciplinary style was pretty authoritarian. Each one of us, I doubt this applies to the girls, but each one of us boys would have been spanked, I remember once. Who knows, with Bill and Hal, that's a whole other story. They were incorrigible. You cannot imagine how incorrigible. Bill wrecked a very, very expensive car one night and came home drunk and explained to Dad that an owl had hit the car. and smashed the whole front
end.
An owl? Mm-hmm, an owl had done that. Right. Well, David and I were asleep, allegedly, and that argument got pretty heated. I don't know this for sure. I have a feeling my brother Bill socked Dad. I'm not sure about that. And Hal was even worse. According, Elizabeth won't talk about her experiences with her older brother, other than to say he was very mean. So where that came from in terms of Dad's modeling parental authority, I can only assume came from there. But he was not that kind of father. I mean, he would tell you what to do, and he'd expect you to do it. And if you didn't, there'd be discipline. It wouldn't be physical, necessarily. But it wasn't, he wasn't an ogre in any way, shape, or form. And Mother was the peacemaker. Mother was, she was a middle child in her family. David and I are middle children mm-hmm. in our family. So she was the peacemaker. Everybody get along. And yeah, you got to do what your dad said, but let's just get over that and mm-hmm. go on with mm-hmm. stuff. Mother's day-to-day parenting, you have to remember she had 8 kids. Mm-hmm. And they were born in a period, and none of us more than 2 years apart. So she had this little flock of geese all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you do? Mm-hmm. There's a story about her asking her mother what to do with all these kids, and her mother, they're from fairly humble background. Mom's dad owned a service station in Russellville, mm-hmm. and there's stories about dealing with the Ku Klux Klan over there, but who related this story? I didn't hear it firsthand. I think Elizabeth told us this. Mother was crying to her mother. At that time, I think she had 5 kids, and half of us were in diapers or some stage of dependency on her. And she said, "I just don't know what to do. This is going to drive me crazy and pull my hair out." And her mother, whom we called Mama Nell, in a southern accent that I can't do justice to, said something like, "Well, honey, just hire yourself some help." So
that was pretty good.
So we got a maid who turned out to be a very close friend of the family, stayed very, very close to us. 2 women worked for my mother over a long period of time. And Dora Jordan, who's dead, and the other woman, I don't remember her name. But they both came to her funeral, for example. And so Mother's parenting style was very much keep the flock together, keep you out of trouble, not really any hard discipline at all. Mother was the one that helped at least me. I'm sure this was with the other kids. With homework, checking to make sure assignments got done, that kind of stuff. Dad was not a real big outdoorsman. But I know he was there at our Little League games and stuff like that. I think all of us probably remember taking hikes with him. Mm-hmm. His business was on the outskirts of town, next to a lake that was an abandoned rock quarry. And it was called Blue Lake.
Okay.
That's why his business was called Blue Lake Block Company.
So in its original inception, was it Russellville Concrete Products, and then it went to
Russellville. So that's kind of a complicated story.
Okay, if you could tell it, that would be great, because I'm a little confused about it. Yeah.
Russellville Concrete Products eventually became owned by my mother's brother.
Okay.
Eventually.
But it was originally owned by
It was originally founded by my grandfather.
Your grandfather, okay.
Daddy Brents, okay. As we called him.
And could you spell Brents just really quickly?
Brent with an S on it.
Okay.
End of it. Yeah.
Okay.
B-R-E-N-T-S.
Okay.
He started that. So Kentucky's got so many weird little things in its history. At one point, the concrete producers in Kentucky, along with the funeral directors, convinced the legislature to pass a law that required you, A, be buried in a casket, and that casket, if you were to be buried underground, not in a mausoleum, had to be encased in a concrete vault. What? So, the impetus for Daddy Brents, who was a funeral director, to be involved in the concrete business was burial vaults. There's a lot of lore in the family. I think it was a pretty simple thing. Dad went off to school to be a pharmacist. That didn't work. He moved to Detroit, I think, again, to go to more pharmacy school. That didn't work. He ended up being a bus driver while he was there. Came back to Russellville. And I think he went into partnership with his dad in this concrete thing. Well, the boy's got to have a job, right? That's me putting my spin on it. Who knows what the truth is?
Gotcha.
And then eventually they decided to move that business to Hopkinsville. Very short. And that was in right after I was born. I was born in November, and that following January they moved it to Hopkinsville. I'm sure it had been in planning stages for longer than that. But when they moved it to Hopkinsville, it's interesting. The early photographs are of Dad mixing concrete to go into a machine that made concrete blocks. I can't find any photographs of him making burial vaults, although when I worked, all of us had little summer jobs out there.
Really?
When I worked there, I remember the house, the shed, where they made those burial vaults. That law, I'm sure, became unstuck. I mean, you can die now without being stuck in a concrete vault. So, how exactly that got... I'm sure Russellville Concrete Products was sold to my Uncle Dick, my mother's next older brother. Next younger brother. But I don't know when that happened. It had to be early on because it's been the incorporation of Blue Lake Block Company was in the way early 50s.
Okay.
So I don't know what, you know, all that is. But that originally was in Russellville, and it was Dad and his dad, Daddy Brents.
Gotcha.
Who was described by his wife as having woken up dead. That's how he passed away. He woke up dead. He had a stroke in his sleep.
Okay.
And his wife, our step-grandmother, reported to us that he just woke up dead in the morning. That's how I want it. I want to wake up dead.
Gotcha.
Too bad you don't have Mama Cotton around or Mama Nell or any of these old folks.
Right.
They were choice.
Yeah.
Cotton was just... pretty gritty old lady from dirt poor origins in Logan County, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was your father's
mother? That was Dad's stepmother. His mother died in his teen years.
Okay.
Flu something or other.
Gotcha.
Consumption. They had all kinds of names for it.
Mm-hmm.
She was a young woman. Maybe... Dad was a teenager, and he was the oldest of the two. Probably early 30s, probably,
gotcha.
Or even younger than that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly. Her name was Nell Hart. And so there are lots of Hart in our family. Dad's middle name was Hart. My oldest brother was Hal Hart Thurman Jr. There's other people sprinkled around who have Hart as part of their name.
But Nell Thurman, she's not Mama Nell, because Mama Nell was your...
She was a height.
Right.
And not, she was not Nell Thurman.
Gotcha. She was your mother's mother. So both your father and your mother had a mother named Nell.
Mama Nell. And actually, Mama Nell, the one we called Mama Nell, her name was Mary Ellen.
Oh. Okay. Gotcha.
And it's possible that Nell Hart was also named Ellen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that for sure.
Right.
Because every record I've seen, it says Nell.
Okay.
But Nell, I think, was a common nickname for Ellen or Eleanor or something.
Interesting.
Yeah. But Mama Nell, mother's mother, her biological mother, she was Mary Ellen. What was her maiden name? She was married to Bill Hite, and I think she was a Morgan, something like that. From Uniontown, I'm getting it confused. It's Morganfield from Union County. So her maiden name was not Morgan.
That's it.
Yeah. Okay. Given infinite time, I would figure it out. So that's the story about the company. When we were little, on Saturdays, Dad would haul all of us out to the block plant, as we called it. Just so we could play on stuff while he was doing whatever he was doing, his Saturday work at the plant, mail, paying bills, whatever. And therein lies every single one of us, I think, including Mary Lou, total fascination with anything that looks like a factory or a big piece of equipment or, you know, a front-end loader or big trucks or any of that sort of stuff. To this day, every one of us.
Just because you had that.
We did it on the weekends.
Yeah.
We were little bitty kids, and I don't know that anybody taught us how to do this. We unloaded rail cars.
Wow.
We just figured it out.
For your father?
Yeah.
Okay.
They had a siding from the L&N that came up beside... So what goes into concrete blocks is essentially sand, gravel, and cement. Mm-hmm. So great big cars loaded with sand, gravel, and cement would come up to the side of the plant to be offloaded. And they had two or three different places where they were offloaded. Not any real magic to it. You just get under it. There's a hopper door that falls out and a little metal chock that's wedged in there to keep the hopper door closed. So we just get under there and... with a hammer and knock it out and get out of the way before the gravel falls on top of you.
Wow.
Yeah. Bill apparently was kind of wild and loose on the forklift, which was a Hyster brand. So until we were adults, we thought all forklifts were Hysters. That's what we called them. And apparently knocked a hole in a big concrete wall in the factory with one time. Mark, as a fairly young kid, not even 10 maybe, rolled something, maybe a front end loader. So there was the block plant property, a road right next to it, right next to this rail spur, and then this lake. And there was a big cliff down to the lake. Well, this front-end loader ended up halfway down that cliff
one day.
Just kind of rolled.
How did your father get anything done?
I don't remember. First of all, nobody died.
Yeah.
And I don't remember him being angry about that stuff.
Yeah.
I think, not that he expected it, but it was like, okay, you let your kids loose at a block plant that has a front-end loader and a Hyster and all this other stuff, and you expected what? I think so. I don't think it's a big surprise to him. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Pretty interesting guy.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. So that was about his parenting style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he died when David was in law school first year, and I was a senior at Bellarmine. And so that left three young kids at home. Mark, what was Mark doing? He might have been going to community college in Hopkinsville. There was a time there where Mark joined the circus for a while.
Wow.
Mary Lou was in high school, and I think she was possibly a junior or sophomore, and Patrick would have been 8th grade or something. And so their lives was very, very different, very different. Dad was the last few years, 3 or 4 years of his life, pretty ill. He died of his third heart attack. So he was not well. Inveterate smoker, never saw a piece of fat meat that he didn't like. Bacon was a religion. I'm making all that up. Who knows? We had bacon and eggs a lot when we were kids. So they have different memories of his parenting with him because he was sick and wasn't very active. I just remember us being outdoors a lot. Authoritarian, compassionate. Got spanked once.
Gotcha.
That was it.
And your mother was the peacemaker.
Oh yeah. Oh God. Now, don't y'all fight. Come in here. Let's talk about that. That was mother. You know, she had an interesting role in their involvement in civil rights and social justice was very much a team thing. And this is a little bit of an exaggeration, probably, but Dad was kind of the lead man, and Mother was, you know, if there's a committee to be on, a process to follow, a meeting to have, Mother was kind of that, the peacemaker.
Gotcha.
And I think that, you know, as kids, this wasn't like a topic. Here's our civil rights stand for the day. It was just example and behavior, you know? So there wasn't like a Thurman school of how to be a child of a civil rights leader. Just, it just happened. Mother was, I think with both girls, very much Mary Lou especially, but I think this is true of Elizabeth. You know, she was pretty traditional. She wanted to see them marry a dentist or a doctor or, you know, something like that. And it became obvious that Elizabeth was very talented, had strong leadership and speaking skills, excelled in debate in high school and all sorts of stuff, and excelled in all sorts of stuff in college. And I think to some extent that's not that it surprised Mother. It wasn't what Mother thought would happen. And then Mary Lou was just a rebel. She just didn't, never did what Mother told her to do.
Wow.
So.
Goddamn. So you said that your parents led by example, and apart from your father being on all these types of organizations, either statewide or nationally, what were some of the things that they did just in the day-to-day goings-on of your family? What were those examples?
That's a good question. One was to make sure that we were exposed. You know, if you grew up white in Hopkinsville, you didn't have to be exposed to anything but the white grocery store, the white schools, the white churches, you know, anything white. So they were dedicated to making sure that if we had a carpool, which we did occasionally to school, there was a black kid in the car. There was a black family in our carpool. If there was some social occasion, and this would have been later because I think when Elizabeth grew up, you know, all of the social stuff she and Hal went to would have been white club, country club, little boy, little girl kind of stuff. But if there was anything social or church or anything, they made sure that we were exposed to people who weren't the same social class as us, the same race as us. You know, even doing things like the women who worked for my mother were black. It was pretty traditional. But we never were allowed to think of them as servants. More, as a matter of fact, they had more day to day when they were there at the house. They had more authority over us than anyone else. They could tell us what to do, and we were expected to do it.
What was that relationship like?
Oh, you know, depending on the day or the circumstance or how old you were, it was like, oh, here's another somebody tell me what to do. Or it was just another a parent figure who was helping you get along. Dora, I don't know why it was me, but Dora taught me how to press shirts. So I can't remember how long ago, I ironed all of my shirts, always. And at some point I got paid for doing it, like a nickel a shirt or something. And Dora's the one who taught me how to do it. So, and in that relationship, this wasn't my mother's servant showing me, it was another adult showing me how to do something useful. And I think I even learned how to iron sheets, maybe. So that was the day-to-day, how did it get implemented stuff. Just, we're going to go here because, for no reason, we're just going to go here and do this. And by the way, there are lots of black people here. We went to, occasionally, not very often, but we went to services, either Easter, a wedding, a funeral, whatever, at black churches. And, you know, it was very different. Most of the black churches around us were Baptist. So very different from a Catholic church, was still trying to make kids pronounce things in Latin at the time, with Father Glahn's back to us. So when we went to these other churches, it was just wildly different, you know. None of that reserved language you couldn't understand, but emotional, excited, joyous stuff. So very, very different. We learned from that. The priest in Hopkinsville were never very much on Dad's team in terms of
Really?
his, at least as far as I recall. When I was a little kid, there was Father Willett there, and he just seemed to be a big badass, you know, just the priest that, you know, if you were an altar boy, you're just as likely to get whacked for doing something as anything else. And he had a young assistant, don't remember his name, Griffin, Griffith, something. And that they were pretty much, you know, please don't get us in trouble, don't rock the boat. We're just a little Catholic place here. We're trying to get along. We don't want bad things to happen. And then Father Glahn, who was the guy that I remember as a teenager, who was the pastor there, he was just a real old-time traditional Catholic priest. When all of the changes came through the Vatican Council, he didn't like most of them, just sort of passively resisted. You know, they made him turn his altar around. They made him quit speaking Latin. He was very condescending to my mother and other women. Didn't think they, you know, keep your mouth shut kind of stuff.
What did your mother think about that?
Oh, she was a real tough opponent of him. She'd stand up to him. You know, back in those days. And I don't think the Catholic Church really changed very much. Maybe stylistically they have, but back in those days, women weren't allowed on the altar at all. So if you were female, you couldn't come on that hallowed ground up there around the altar, really. And mother just couldn't take it, you know. So if there was any sort of, like there'd be something going on at a higher level that mother would find out about in Owensboro, or something the Pope was doing that would allow women to do certain things, like be on the altar as a something, whatever, She would tell Father Glahn, I want to do that. And he'd say, no way. And she'd say, well, I'm going to complain to the bishop about it. And she did. And Father Glahn got his hands whacked, and Mother and other women got to do it. At the time, the only thing that was legal for women to do in the church was take care of cleaning in the hallowed altar space. Mm. You know, you could go change the altar linens and get wine stains out of them and all that sort of stuff. But so she was very much an activist, not in terms of protest, but, you know, you think you're going to tell me what to do? Well, we'll see. We'll go talk to your boss and see what your boss has to say about it. She, at Dad's funeral, Father Glahn wanted to be the big dog. And I don't think she let him celebrate the Mass, I don't think. There was a younger guy who had been his assistant who corrected some of the stuff he said on Lenten Sunday, or Easter Sunday once. Who was that guy? Father... Another young guy. But she had a good relationship. Mm-hmm. So she asked him to celebrate the Mass. It just fried Father Glahn.
Mm-hmm.
This is my church.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think he died not long after that.
Wow.
So she was very much an activist for rights, mostly her own rights,
mm-hmm.
when it came to that. We had an argument in college. I think Dad had died. Mother and I had this argument. Some female had become the head of something, some commission or something. And in reference to that person in a conversation with Mother, I called her a chairwoman.
Mm.
And Mother said, no, she's a chairperson. And I said, well, why? If it's a chair, if it's a male, he's a chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a woman, she's a chairwoman, right?
Mm-hmm.
She said, no. Why does their gender make any difference?
Mm.
And this was a really long time ago,
mm-hmm.
before people had conversations.
Yeah.
Or before people commonly had conversations about mm-hmm. that. So her style was very much just personal
mm-hmm.
and interpersonal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reacting with you about your beliefs.
Yeah.
And she did that with a lot of people, not just us, but
mm-hmm.
all of her friends. They had really good friends who basically stopped their friendship over Mom and Dad's involvement. Kenneth and Dottie Casey. Mercantile family owned department store, furniture store, stuff like that in Hoptown. And I think after Dad died, Mother went out of her way to kind of heal that friendship. You know, we don't want you to think, and no, we're not going to change our opinion about anything, and we're not going to change our behavior. But look, our kids grew up together. We're not evil people. And I think that did get repaired after Dad's death, and Mother worked on it. That did get repaired. Of course, I was gone. Once I was out of high school, I was done with Hopkinsville.
Do you want to comment on that at all?
Well, Hoptown?
Yeah,
why? My greatest achievement in high school was leaving Hopkinsville. I don't really care. We don't have any family there, and I don't have mm-hmm. any close friends there. I don't really care. But, you know, growing up, it was just a good old boy, not the kind of place that was amenable to a lot of my friends,
mm-hmm.
to ideals and norms that we had. I was just really glad to leave, really happy to leave. I came to the big city, Louisville, went to college, Bellarmine. Mm-hmm. I think there was one black person at Bellarmine, maybe, at the time. Mm-hmm. Might be two now, huh?
It's actually really, it's growing. It's becoming way more diverse.
I know, and I'm very sarcastic about this stuff, just to disclaim everything.
Mm-hmm.
Sarcastic old man.
So where do you think your parents found their commitment to equality, to social justice, to activism? Did it, was it through Catholicism? You said he, your father was, liked the ideas of Catholic social teaching. Is that where it came from, or?
You know, I don't know which was the chicken or the egg. Mm-hmm. I really don't. They were married. Mother was 17 or something. She wasn't 18, I don't think. In the priest's rectory, because at the time Catholics couldn't have a Catholic wedding to a Protestant. Mm-hmm. God forbid that something awful like that would happen. But there was something about the Catholic profession of the gospel that really touched Dad. And after, I don't know if you recall all this, but at the time, the real social justice activist people in the church were pretty much Catholic. Mm-hmm. There were some Protestants and some Jews, but like a lot of Jesuits, mm-hmm. you know, really on the front line, Daniel Berrigan, you know, people like that, very, very active in the civil rights movement. And the Kennedys were all Catholic. And for some reason, Dad was totally in love with the Kennedys. So the attraction may have been he just saw through the idealism of these other people that he respected, he saw that the basis of that for them was Catholicism. I think that's more likely than just thinking, oh man, those Catholics, look at that. Because he sure didn't have any affection for that little backwater church down there, St. Peter and Paul Catholic Church. Did I offend? Have I left anybody out here? Father Glahn, Father Willett? So I just don't think there was anything really spectacular about that church so much. And then when Dad converted, which I'm sure I was in grade school when it happened. You know, he took on a whole bunch of Catholic practices that weren't just the window dressing stuff. You know, he really took the Lenten season of penance really seriously. He did a regular, when I say regular, probably annual retreat. Mm-hmm. There's a place near Cincinnati on the Kentucky side. Maybe it's in Erlanger, maybe. There's a monastery up there. Mount something or Holy something or Holy Mount something or Mount Mother of Good Grief.
Notre Dame is up there. They have that Notre Dame Cathedral and the school.
No, this... It's a cloistered... It may not even exist anymore. Okay. Yeah, there were some brothers and monks there. Who knows how Dad got to know them? Who knows? He had his ways. Anyway, he went to retreats at least once a year to that place, and then there was another place, another cloistered kind of place over in western Kentucky near Russellville somewhere. Mm-hmm. And he took that period of reflection and spiritual growth. He took it really, really seriously. So, I don't think that Catholicism, his view of the way Catholicism supported his beliefs about justice and peace, I think Catholicism was the convenient platform for it. And he was a religious person, so, yeah.
Gotcha.
I called him names, though. I was, I was a smart-ass freshman at Bellarmine involved in whatever peace movement, anti-war stuff I could get my hands on. And he came to see David and I don't remember why this conversation even came up. But at the time, Blue Lake Block Company was building on-site housing for married soldiers at Fort Campbell. And I just told Dad he was another part of the machine, of the war machine. It was immoral. You shouldn't do it. It's probably what put me through college. Probably.
Yeah. And so your brother, Bill, he fought in Vietnam.
Is that Bill? Correct? When did Bill... he enlisted... let's see. Bill graduated from high school 64, maybe. Early. And everything in the world was boring to him. He tried to go to the community college. They couldn't keep him interested. Plus, you have to remember, this is a womanizer. When he was in high school, by the time he graduated from high school, there was not a parent, this is serious, who would allow him to date their daughters in Hopkinsville or Christian County.
Yeah.
He was really bad. I mean, really bad. We don't have to say any more about that, but he's pretty bad. So, there was no action in Hopkinsville. There was nothing stimulating. So he just thought, what the heck? Sign up for Vietnam, see what's over there. Once he got into the system, they found out how just deadly smart he was. Mm-hmm. Usually anybody who ends up in the officer corps, at least back then, if you went to officer candidate school, the next day you were on a boat for Vietnam. Yeah. And green lieutenants, the only people who had a higher death rate than green lieutenants were green privates. So they just cannon fodder. So we all thought, well, you know, Bill, you're just going to die going over there. But he got into the system, the training system. They found out how smart he was. They sent him to all kinds of specialty schools. He went to finance school and came out as a finance officer, which in the context of the way the military was structured back then, each division would basically have a CFO. And those finance officers were the CFOs. Like the quartermaster people, they knew everything. They knew if money was being sent one way or another. The quartermaster knew how to get scotch, you know, that sort of stuff. And they were very well protected. Bill saw, his division was stationed inside combat zones, but the headquarters component that included the general of that division and all of like finance people and that sort of stuff, way back in the middle, way out of harm's way. And just once or twice he would have picked up, I think just once, guard duty outside the fence. I think one night is what he told us. He used to send audio tapes home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they're probably just destroyed. But, you know, it's the only night he ever carried a rifle. I mean, actually in mm-hmm. his hands mm-hmm. in case he saw somebody, he'd shoot him.
Yeah.
Bill and I never had any animosity at all. And I guess, you know, it was just, you know, that's what you chose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't become a bad person. You just yeah. chose that.
Mm-hmm.
But Bill was also really smart. Don't forget that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a bit of a wheeler dealer. And don't forget, quite a ladies' man. He was just a whoremonger. And he was awful. Anyway, Bill found out that job as the finance officer at a divisional level, it would put him in a combat zone. So he qualified for combat pay. It's like another 50% bonus on top wow. of your base pay. And Vietnam was overseas. So mm-hmm. you got overseas pay. And that was another 50% bonus on top mm-hmm. of your pay. And he really thought, hey, I guess they could blow the whole army up and that would hurt me. But I'm not really in any risk and I'm getting double pay. So mm-hmm. why wouldn't I do this?
Mm-hmm.
So he not only did he volunteer for the Army, he volunteered for Vietnam, he volunteered for a second tour of duty. He was wow. in Vietnam for 2 years.
Wow.
Then in 60? This must have been 68. No, I was still in high school. So 67, maybe 68. He came out of the army in San Francisco. He calls, I think he called Dad. And he said, I'm going to get home, but I'm bringing my wife with me. There had never been any mention of anything. Mm-hmm. I'm bringing my wife. And so we're going to need a place to live. So if you guys can help us figure that out, that'd be great. And I'm probably going to need a job. So if you can figure that out, that'd help. He had twice gone to Taiwan on R&R, relaxation and rabble rousing or whatever that stands for. And both times he had visited and gotten intimate with this cocktail waitress at a bar in Taiwan who spoke absolutely no English.
Wow.
And her name was Mei Li, don't remember her last name, Miko for short.
Mm-hmm.
That's who he married in Taiwan and brought her back to the States.
Wow.
And said, hey, who's my wife? Well, that's a whole life. You know, the mm-hmm. two of them raised two children. Bill was diagnosed with MS shortly after his return from Vietnam. Over the years, he was progressively disabled. He was a quadriplegic when he died. You know the circumstances of his death?
A
died
bit.
In a house fire. Mm-hmm. House fire. Mm-hmm. Their eldest, John, number one in his class at Notre Dame, was in Naval ROTC, flew through the initial training up in Great Lakes Training Center. His passion from the time he was a little kid, he wanted to be a Top Gun fighter. So he flew through the preliminary aviation training up there. He got selected for Top Gun school.
Wow.
Big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Huge. And remember, at this time, his dad's a quadriplegic. They drove down to Pensacola, Florida, or they were driving to Pensacola from Chicago, and recently married. They'd been married the previous December. This was middle of summer. Or no, this was, excuse me, it was Labor Day weekend. Drove through Hopkinsville to celebrate with mom and dad on the way to Top Gun school. Nobody really, really knows how this house fire got started. It started in the kitchen. It was probably a faulty wiring, mm-hmm. probably. Nobody really knows. Monica was a teenager. His little sister was a teenager, 12 or 13. John and Trish were staying in the house with them when the house caught on fire late at night. Miko, mom, sent them over to neighbors' houses, go wake everybody up. I think John had already called 911. So she got them out of eyesight of the house, and she went back in the house, which you never do.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them died
wow.
of smoke inhalation.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was supposed to be quite a celebratory, mm-hmm. glorious weekend turned into be just utterly tragic. John went on to Top Gun school, flunked out, lost his nerve, crashed simulators, and his commander could have, I mean, they could have demoted him and packed him off to something else. But John, like his dad, real high IQ, really smart guy, his commander said, there is something you might be interested in. How would you like to be part of the Signal Corps? Well, the Signal Corps now is IT. That's okay. what the Signal Corps is. They used to stand on the decks of
yeah.
and do flags, mm-hmm. and I think they might still do that. But mm-hmm. what the Signal Corps really does is they're the IT guys.
Wow.
So John ends up on Abraham Lincoln, maybe? One of the big nuclear carriers. As the what do they call him? Signal Corps commander or chief or whatever mm-hmm. he was. So he was the chief information officer of a big ship.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Bill's Bill's, you know, MS would have killed him eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And so for it to have been that way and for it to have been both of John's parents, Bill turned into a very sweet, funny, disabled guy. And had a great sense of humor about his disability.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't give up driving until they absolutely took it out of his hands.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he was in a wheelchair, he got the VA to put a ramp on his vehicle, all the assistive stuff to let him drive. And they had to take it away from him to get him out of there. But real funny, fun person to be around. I talked to him somewhere in this. There was always some, drama's the wrong word, there was always some conflict with the VA going on, constant. And somebody like Bill, whose condition was very long-term, and would have these long, years-long plateaus of there's no change, you just come see the doctor, get this pill, just listen to your heart, you go, okay, blah, 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 prescription for a wheelchair, blah, blah, blah. He would suddenly fall off the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a dramatic, like, paralysis of his entire esophagus. So he couldn't swallow, and at one point couldn't breathe. And this was... You know, Mika was very strong, but Bill was just, you know, you're not going to kill me this way kind of guy. So he would fight them tooth and nail. When he was in the emergency room, barely able to draw a breath, really, he'd be fighting the VA over, what do you mean I can't get admitted to the hospital in Nashville? You want me to die in Hopkinsville, or you just want me to go down there and die? What do you want?
Mm-hmm.
Huh? He was pretty hardcore about that.
Yeah.
Bill also came to have pretty strong anti-war views, as I think not all veterans, but many people who went to Vietnam and saw what was really going on, especially, you know, the black people are the ones who are dying, they're killing brown people, and it's the white people who are telling them to do it.
Right.
A lot of guys saw that and came back and were involved in the anti-war movement. Bill was pretty strong. I don't know how. There was a veterans march in Louisville. I have no idea how he got up here. I might have gone down to get him, I don't know.
Wow.
So how did we get that started, Bill?
You were talking about your anti-war stances at Bellarmine and your relationship with your father, and I was just wondering how that carried over into your relationship with
Bill. You know, so Dad was... social justice was kind of the core value.
Mm-hmm.
So justice based on social wrongs.
Mm-hmm.
So eliminating injustice that was because of social status some way or another, whether it was because you were black or poor or left-handed or anything.
Mm-hmm.
He was not, you know, he may have come to this, I don't know, because his last 3 or 4 years, he was so sick, we didn't have arguments over stuff. But when I was a sophomore, this was just when the draft was being turned into a lottery, if you read about that.
Mm-hmm.
So the draft was a very weird system. It was used to put Muhammad Ali in jail because of his religious principles. And it was used as a way to make sure a bunch of white kids didn't have to go to war and a bunch of black kids did. And it was not just in the South. It was all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when you look at who died in Vietnam and who went to Vietnam, they were very much not white.
Mm-hmm.
Very much. So, in response to, was Nixon president? This might have happened under Johnson, but I think Nixon is the one who implemented it. They kicked out the local draft authority, the local draft board. So a bunch of, usually white guys, who were like lawyers and doctors and dentists, would sit in a room and say, he goes, he goes, he goes, he doesn't go, for whatever random reason. Instead of that, everyone was assigned a lottery number. And I think you were assigned the lottery number when you turned 18, I think. And then annually, the Department of Defense would tell the system, look, we think we're going to need this many hundreds of thousands of bodies to send over there. So use the draft, come up with a top number, and announce we're going to call up to numbers, blah, 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 blah. Well, they hadn't announced the lottery yet, and I had been working with a couple of friends here and in New York and Chicago about what I really believed, mm-hmm. And came to understand that I still believe this, I don't think the government, it's like the Fourth Amendment says the government can't come take your property from you. Well, why can they take me, mm-hmm. you know? So I don't believe that the draft is, I don't believe it's constitutional, and it is certainly not moral. Mm-hmm. for you to be conscripted, you know, part of the Revolutionary War was fought over that, mm-hmm. even though the Union Army conscripted people like everybody else did. Anyway, so I drafted this letter. I've got a copy of it somewhere. To the draft board, and in very highfalutin moral language said, take this draft card and shove it. Mm-hmm. I don't believe you have the authority over me to make me carry this card. I don't think that you have the right to tell me what to do with my life. And then I went on to say, if you call me to serve, I will not comply, and don't mistake this as asking you to make me a conscientious objector. Mm-hmm. That's just another part of you taking my life away from me. So, here, stuff this where the sun doesn't shine. I didn't say that, but before I did that, I had some really long conversations, first with Dad, because I wanted to know, I said, you know, that I could go to jail. Mm-hmm. And if I did that, what would you do? What would you think about it? And his response was, well, first of all, I would be glad that you decided what your conscience told you to do, mm-hmm. first. And then secondly, I don't know if they put you in jail. I don't know. Where are you going to go? How would we? I don't know. We'll just have to see what happens. Mm-hmm. And then my sister, Mary Lou, did you talk to her? Or is somebody going to talk to her?
We're going to try. I think her schedule
is goofy.
Yeah. But I think we're
going to try to. Mm-hmm. She remembers Dad telling the kids who were still at home, you know, something, this could happen. And if it does happen, he's your brother. We support him. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I wasn't part of that conversation. Well, nothing ever happened. I sent it, registered, return receipt. I got the receipt back. Nothing. So that was a felony. When I sent that card back and said what I said, mm-hmm. that's a felony, not carrying that. It's a federal felony, maybe a state crime too. Nada. Nothing. Not a phone call, not a letter that says, do you know what you're doing, you crazy fool? Nothing. So a few months went by. I don't know how long, it was more, maybe not a year. Nothing ever happened. The lottery was announced. My number was within the national number that they, so had they ever gotten to my number, they would have drafted me and I would have not gone. And that would have precipitated the confrontation. in Kentucky, for some reason, they never got to my number. My number was something like 174, something like that, and they got to like 168. So they never called my number.
Wow.
So I told my dad, I said, you know, it's just, I was not wanting to be arrested and go to jail. But I thought I could be, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of surprised I wasn't, because yeah. people all over the country were doing this,
mm-hmm.
and they got arrested and sent to jail.
Mm-hmm.
He was still an influential businessman. I said, "Did you?" And I'm sure he knew people on that draft board. I'm sure he did.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Did you mess with this? Did you get in the way?" Scott's honor. I didn't have anything to do with it. Okay. And then after he died, I asked Mother, I said, Dad, it's still to me, you know, they were putting kids in jail all over the country just for sending their draft, for burning their draft cards.
Mm-hmm.
And no, but not only didn't they mess with me, they didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even send an FBI agent out to interview me or anything. And Mother said, we didn't have a thing to do with it, have no idea.
Wow.
How that happened. You might want to just keep your mouth shut and don't. So, the point of that whole story is Dad's support. He didn't agree that with my, what he agreed with was I had the right to feel that way, mm-hmm. to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't agree that the draft was unconstitutional or that it was immoral. I think at that point he had come to believe the war. I'm sure he had. Because I Had a Dream speech, Martin Luther King's I Had a Dream, real impactful on him. I think he had come to see the war was immoral, mm-hmm. and he did not support the war, even though the building of all those buildings on a military base put me through college, and David.
Yeah.
So that was kind of an example of how his moral system mm-hmm. supported me. Not that he agreed with my beliefs.
Yeah.
Well,
and also I think it's a good illustration of how your parents' examples of their own activism carried over into your life. And I know your sister spoke about her activism during the feminist movement mm-hmm. and the women's rights mm-hmm. movement. And while that wasn't necessarily directly civil rights as your parents, but you each took that and made it your own and
yeah.
and acted that out in your own way.
You know what I wish? If we could draw those two people out of the grave and put them in this current mm-hmm. milieu. I would really like to know where my parents would see climate change in the social justice paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't take 10 hours to go through this, but to me it's the new racism.
Yeah.
It really is. And denying that we're the cause of it, is just like saying those people don't have the right to vote because they're not fully human.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. And then not taking personal action. It's a thing with me. I don't own a car.
Mm-hmm.
And my kids just moved out to Prospect. That's nearly impossible to do without a car.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nearly impossible to live here without a car.
In Louisville, of course. Yeah.
When I lived near Seattle, it was not only possible, you paid a real penalty for owning a car there. It was
mm-hmm.
very inconvenient. You never find a place to park. It's extremely inexpensive. I mean, expensive to own a vehicle. And transit was everywhere. I lived on an island.
Wow.
I would walk to the bus stop, get on the free bus on the island to go to the ferry. I've got my smart card around here somewhere. take my smart card, hit the little box on the ferry, go across, either take a commuter bus or the train, hit the little box. These are totally separate systems. Mm. The ferry system is one thing. Mm-hmm. The train system is another one. The bus system is another one. Get to downtown Seattle, get on the light rail, hit the little box again, go to the airport, hit the little box to say I'm done. It was all one thing, and it took less time than a car.
Wow.
So I'm a little bit of a arsehole about, we have a third-rate transit system. The leadership of that transit system is, God bless them. Mm-hmm. Man, I'm sure they have nice mothers, and they were probably good children, but mm-hmm. you know, the fact that TARC has 40 driver openings, can't fill them. They have two simultaneous classes of 30 each. After the second week, each class has 1/3 of the people that signed up. So, anyway, that's to me, that's the new area of social justice, mm-hmm. is carbon and, you know,
yeah.
my grandchildren. The path they're on right now is that they're each going to have a car, and they're going to have a car. Mm-hmm. But at some point, having a car will mean that people in Bangladesh die. And it already means, can't not happen, that most of Florida is going to be underwater in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And who's going to be underwater? Yeah, some rich people are going to lose some condos, big deal. But mostly poor people, black people, brown people, mostly. That's who's going to suffer. Ask me who I voted for.
Yes. I think that's all.
Are we done?
The official questions I have. If you want to add anything, feel free to...
Well, I appreciate the two of you taking
all this time. We appreciate you
to do it
as well.
So, Emma, how does this technically become part of the Oral History Project, the History Commission, Council?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can.
Department of Archives, how does all that?
Yeah, I can explain all that. You've said your piece.
I think so,
okay. Alrighty, thank you very much.
Don't ask me to talk more.